Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live webinar. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Neil Gorthy, Senior Portfolio Manager and Head of the Asia Strategy at Avenue Capital Group, a global opportunistic credit and special situations manager with $11.8 billion of assets under management as of February of 2022. Anil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited. I was thinking back, it wasn't too long ago, we had another Avenue representative, Mark Lazary, join probably in the spring or so of 2021. So it's good to have Avenue back on the show. Perhaps to start, you could walk everyone through a little bit about your background and sort of your current role at Avenue.
Sure. So I started my career in finance and investing over 20 years ago. My first job was with Deutsche Bank, Alex Brown, in Singapore, doing technology and telecom banking. I parlayed that experience in telecom into the distress group at Deutsche, where, when Asia was going through a big crisis in the telecom space, the adoption in telecom hadn't taken off yet, and there was a lot of debt in the telecom companies. So we took advantage of it, made a lot of money in the distressed debt. I moved on into doing other countries in the region using telecoms, but then moved on to steel, textiles, petrochemicals, et cetera. In 2009, I left and joined a firm called PAG, Pacific Alliance, at the time, which is now a big player in the space, doing to help establish the illiquid business. In 2015, I joined Avenue Capital. And as you know, Mark Lazary, we got on very well, and I took on the business of rebuilding the Avenue Asia business. Today, we have 18 people on the ground across 5 offices, and we have an experienced platform that is taking care of lending, special situations, and traded debt as well. So we are a full-fledged platform doing Asia credit end-to-end.
And so, how does kind of the Asia strategy overall fit within Avenue, and how would you kind of describe Avenue overall in terms of, their expertise and market focuses?
Look, your audience probably has met Mark Lazary. Mark is a very experienced practitioner of the distressed debt world. Mark and Sonia founded the firm over 25 years ago. And Avenue was one of the few players that came into Asia right after the financial crisis in 1997. So Avenue has been on the ground in Asia for almost now 22, 23 years. There are very few players in the region or global managers who spend that much time in Asia. That's a very, very big, important thing, because when you've been investing in a space for that long, you learn a lot of things of what to do and what not to do. And as an investor, you need to have both of those in your toolkit. And our DNA is very much the Avenue's DNA, which is you have to be local in those markets. You have to understand that you're trying to take an advantage of a dislocated seller. And it's not about necessarily non-performing assets. It's actually about distressed sellers rather than distressed assets. Being able to take advantage of it and generating returns for investors is what we do. That's our focus.
And I'm kind of curious that, right? You made a comment about how, at least Mark and the leadership team at Avenue kind of identified Asia as a market that they really want to have a presence in. That sounds as though it's, 2 decades now in length. What do you think was kind of going through their minds at that point, seeing, the opportunity in Asia? And how do you think that they kind of identified Asia as one that they wanted to have a core business in?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of a very good question, because there are, at the time, Asia had went through a very large financial crisis in 1997, which was more a currency crisis. So perfectly good companies suddenly had their debt overnight double. So you had to make a choice. Are these companies going to go default, or are there some of them going to come back and really take the wind of in the sails and Asia's growth? Because 22 years ago, Asia was a much smaller region economically. Today, it is a very large, if you add China, India, Japan, et cetera, these are bigger than the US as a market. So at that time, Mark saw this opportunity saying, let's just go through this financial crisis. Let's pick up through the rubble and see what makes sense and take advantage of it and provide better investors. And those first two funds of Avenue, which Mark was looking at, ended up being very, very good returns and reflective of the opportunity set. 20 years later, if you go through all the effect of the macro, if you're looking at COVID, if you're looking at everything that's happening, Asia is still growing at a much higher pace than the rest of the world, at a steady clip of around 4 to 5% across the spectrum. And now when you look at it, today the debt is around 40 trillion. It is a huge opportunity set. So we are back one full cycle in defining again, is it a great opportunity set and how do we take advantage of it? So I think it's very reflective of what the DNA and Avenue, and specifically Mark saw that at the time, is come back full circle.
How is that kind of persistence, right? And I mean this both in terms of like the depth of time, and then also I imagine, and I want to spend some time around the importance of boots on the ground relative to some other folks that might participate in these markets, but really do so from on a domestic basis, meaning being based here in the US. But really, how is that kind of depth of time created, if any at all, relationships in these markets and perhaps enhanced access that other firms or institutions are kind of struggling with?
Yeah, very good question. Asia is, I would say one thing very clearly, the perceived risk in Asia from someone sitting in New York is always higher than the real risk. Someone like me who spent all my life in Asia, I kind of live here, we kind of spend our offices in Singapore, Hong Kong, Sydney, Beijing and New Delhi, we kind of live and breathe these geographies. And these two things are very linked, because 20 years ago, or 15 years ago even, when I was doing deals in credit, I used to worry about the enforceability. I was worried about bankruptcy law. Today, if you look at it, half of Asia, the markets that we target are Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, you have South Korea and Japan. These are all developed markets. So if you think about the opportunity set, there are a whole bunch of developed markets which operate exactly like the US or the UK, the Western markets from a credit enforcement perspective. Then you have markets like India and China. 10 years ago, you could have said, well, these markets are completely not enforceable. Today, they've come a long way. China has a bankruptcy code that has become better. India has started a new bankruptcy code in 2016, which is getting implemented really well. And all of those changes have made Asia as a geography much better today than it was the previous iteration 20 years ago. But still, to be able to be successful in doing this investment here, because India and China, for example, are not currency open markets, you can't take $100 into China and say, I want to buy this debt from a local bank. You're not legally allowed to carry dollars into China. So you need to have a license. And same as in India, you need to have a license that allows you to go and buy the debt, and you create, put your name as a secured lender. We spent a lot of time over the last 7 years in Avenue to build those licenses. So if you ask me what is the advantage on the boots on the ground, one simple fact, in my team, most of the members of my team speak, other than English, they speak at least one or two languages. So I have Chinese speakers in China, I have people who speak Hindi or something else in India, and we have similarly people in Hong Kong or Indonesia. So this is a language is a very important barrier. The second thing is understanding the local customs and working with this people, local sourcing, and we'll come to that at some point, is again a very local nuanced topic. The third thing is these licenses. Without these three, what you're doing out of London and New York is you're making an assumption on a lot of things from up top. So I think if you ask me, I personally can't see any other way someone can responsibly be investing in Asia without the boots on the ground. It's very difficult. It's almost impossible, I would say. So our model is built for a long-term, being close to what the credit is and delivering differentiated return.
And, you know, just in terms of the boots on the ground, I imagine over the course of 22 years, you know, Avenue overall has developed some deep relationships. Has that provided you guys better access or better opportunities where, you know, maybe you're an early call relative to some opportunities maybe than some other participants?
Absolutely. Avenue is a name that is known. And again, we are not trying to be everything to everybody. Avenue is a name that is known in the stressed, distressed, special situations and credit space. Globally, we are more in the distressed space. Here in Asia, we do a broader range. So we call ourselves opportunistic credit, and we try to do, so there's a very high recall for people to think, okay, if I'm under any kind of stress, let me just reach out to the Avenue guys. In fact, the team itself benefits from having not only team which has got 15 to 20 years experience, but then the Avenue name is something that is a very high recall with all the insolvency practitioners, with local people. We've invested around $6 billion in Avenue over a long period of, $5 billion over the last few 20 years. And that has given us a lot of relationships with individual chairmen of companies or sponsors. And remember, sponsors, unlike institutions, for them it's very personal. They own these businesses. If Avenue's capital saved them 15 years ago, they will come back and still offer a deal to us or discuss a deal with us. That is definitely a big, big positive. And it's a strength that will continue as we build the platform.
And then, you know, you've mentioned quite a bit of all these different, localities kind of in Asia. You know, it's obviously a very expansive market. So how do you and the team, you know, within the Asia strategy context, think about all the different opportunities, and how do you kind of bucket all of them to kind of figure out which ones you want to pursue and kind of what some of the opportunities are there?
So it is a large market. I think for people who don't know, I'm based in Singapore. It's 10 o'clock in the night. If I have to fly to Sydney, it's a 9-hour flight. If I have to fly to Beijing, it is a 6 or 8-hour flight. And Delhi is a 6-hour flight. So it's a wide geography. But when you think about it because we have boots on the ground and we have local offices, my team is meeting these companies and these counterparties all the time. So when a deal comes in, the way we think about the portfolio is we want half of the portfolio to be in developed Asia. So this is where there's a predictability and there is a coupon, and that coupon can be passed on to investors. So we are thinking that we need the developed markets so we can actually send back a yield to our investors. Then we have the emerging markets, which is the other 50%. And there are many countries, but we pick up only 3 countries. So we focus, instead of all the many countries in Asia, we pick up 3 countries on the emerging side because of the size: China, India, and Indonesia. And in these markets, we are expecting to make a multiple of return, because you're taking potentially not the same predictability, but if you want to make a 1.5 or a 2x. So you're trying to fix a time. You can't fix the time, so you fix a multiple. So that's the way we construct the portfolio. Specifically, deals come in our structure. The way we look at it is 40% of our portfolio goes into lending. These are companies that are willing to pledge their real estate hard assets, any real assets. They are willing to pledge cash flows. They're willing to sometimes pledge private equity, majority control in these companies. We lend them money, and we are trying to make a direct lending type of deal. Another 40% of the portfolio goes into buying someone else's debt at a discount and then converting, doing a restructuring, and getting a nice equity kicker apart from the debt, so you can actually make more money on top. And the third is trading opportunities. These are buying bonds or traded paper and then making money on it. So we prioritize in our portfolio how the portfolio is coming in from a geography perspective, whether it's a developed or developing, and then we see where does it fit in a yield or a secondary or a traded bucket. And that is a constant 24/7 job that the team has to construct something which is a return which is coming from yield, a return coming in from recovery on the debt, and the third thing is some equity upside in the portfolio. So these 3 steps are what we're trying to create in the portfolio across all the deals. And that's how the portfolio gets constructed bottom up.
And then when you kind of think overall about, you know, these markets, you know, bifurcated by kind of developed and also emerging, how do you all kind of evaluate or perceive some of the risks there? And I imagine actual versus perceived is, again, something that is a little bit imbalanced or you know, not really the same.
Yeah. So, for example, like if developed or developing, there are a lot of things that come from experience. For example, the developed markets are very fairly well picked over. A lot of people will say, I can enforce in these markets and that's easy. I'll appoint receivers, et cetera. So that's one part of it. One of the things I would say on the developed market side is having boots on the ground helps you to do proprietary deals, where all the deals that we do in Avenue platform, Asia platform, they're all proprietary deals. So we source the deals. And by sourcing a deal, you get 2 big advantages. You are deciding the covenants on these loans. You are negotiating the covenants, you're deciding the covenants, and you're tailoring the covenants that suit you. So that's an important part when you're enforcing. So we actually try not to do syndicated loans in our business because we want to have a fair degree of control of the covenants. The second thing, when you negotiate these deals, you also get into the understanding of where the risk parameters are from the counterparty's perspective. So should we push them? Should we give them an extra 2 weeks of leniency waiver thing, or should we just push them into a receivership or a bankruptcy event? So that's an important thing on the develop side. In the developing side, the experience is even more nuanced. So for example, in India, if you wanted to enforce on a building, and let's say I gave you a pledge on a building, it'll probably take you 2 years or 3 years to get the enforcement done if you're just trying to get a hard a security on the hard collateral. But if you took the same building and you put it into a special purpose vehicle, your ability to enforce is like literally on the press of a button. Because its electronic systems are, these systems, countries have jumped the electronic things so much faster. So in India, you can actually enforce an electronic security in a second. But as a hard security on a building, you'll have to go through the registrar, land enforcement, courts. It takes a long time. So these are nuances that people aren't completely familiar with. But for someone like us who spend a lot of time, this is a great way. So if I take a hard collateral, I'll say, move it into a building. I think I understand it's a bit costly, but let's just do that. And that makes sure that we are actually safer. So that's why the enforcement gets better for those people who are experienced in this. And it has been getting better over time, but there are these nuances which are important.
And especially when, you know, I want to spend a little time in a second or two talking about kind of what, you know, distress special situations really mean and how you all kind of think about it. But certainly, you know, you brought this up before, and I know it's something that a lot of people, you know, have concerns around are, you know, the strength of the institutions and the judicial process, everything in the United States, UK, most of Europe as well is really well documented and gives creditors a lot of comfort knowing that in the event of any insolvency or any issues that they have some protection just based on the institutions. Certainly, you've kind of alluded to how this has been an ongoing trend in the positive direction, but maybe you could kind of walk everyone through how far things have come across all of Asia, but really focusing most on the developing nations as well.
Sure. So I think overall, I think the developed part of Asia, I think is, as you said, it's fairly similar to the US and UK, so it doesn't require any more discussions. In fact, it's because they're all common law countries and they were ex-Commonwealth countries, the UK law wasn't adopted in most of these markets. So it's kind of fairly similar, so we should just go with that. Now, in India and, for example, India and China, the courts, for example, we have definitely seen that in India, because of the bankruptcy process, the 2016 bankruptcy code change, today, earlier, the borrowers could not care less if you were starting a process. They would find very many, because India is a democracy, there is a whole lot of court system delays, they would misuse the court processes. But the current government and the way there has been a long trend on improving the bankruptcy process, today the borrowers are excluded from actually bidding on their own assets. So if you owned a company and let's say somebody owns a company and they went into bankruptcy, they can't even find a way to credit bid or find a partnership to bid it. In fact, they're not allowed, they're excluded from the process. I think that is even harder than what it is in the Western world, in US or UK. So this has kind of put the fear of God in the borrowers. And India went through a change where 2 years ago, they cleaned up 12 big companies, which are the largest companies which have defaulted, and all of them were forced to change hands. So the owners are no longer, once you're declared a bankrupt or a willful defaulter, as they call it, you're not allowed, you're excluded from the process completely, from ownership of assets, which has changed the dynamic substantially. So that has led to a massively improved behavior from borrowers. So today people, the owners of companies are extremely scared of defaulting. So I think that is changing. So this comes from change of law, and two is implementation of law. And that is happening both in India and China. So I would say in some other markets in Asia, it has to still pick up. The reason why we in the developing markets, Avenue Asia focuses on China and India is we are experienced in going to courts in these markets. We are experienced in dealing with it. So, and we think that these have come a long way. I think we are probably, I would say across Asia now between developing markets, especially China, India, your ability to get your asset is somewhere between 3 months to around 2 years maximum. You could get it as quickly in some places as 3 months, and the worst you could get stuck is around 2 years. But that's, remember a while ago that was like 5 years or so, and that's changed. But still, in developed markets, it's probably 6 months, 3 to 6 months. So it's coming in the, they're all converging in terms of time and ease of enforcement.
Okay. And across, you know, kind of the Avenue Asia strategy overall, you've mentioned direct lending, you've mentioned some special situations, you also mentioned some trading debt or traded debt. Maybe you could kind of walk everyone through what all three of those are in the context of kind of the Avenue Asia strategy overall, and then also maybe just a little bit around what the opportunity sets are kind of within each.
Sure. So the first one is direct lending, which is kind of a bit similar to the mid-market lending in the U.S., except in Asia. I think for from a background, the difference between, maybe I should just go a little bit, to take a step back. In the U.S., if whether you're in New York or you're in Dallas or you're in San Francisco, you actually have one currency. You take your dollars, they're worth the same, you have the same Fed policy, you have the same central bank policy, etc. If you come to Asia, China and India and Japan, Korea, they all have their own currencies. They all have their own central bank policies, and it's a very fragmented market that way. So what happens in each of these markets, again, is the companies that are owned by the government or companies that are owned by the large business groups, they have infinite access to capital. Once you come one step below that, you really struggle for lack of capital because the banks are willing to lend to the big boys. They're not willing to lend to everybody down the stream. So when you look at it, a company with perfectly good cash flows and great assets will suddenly struggle to get loans. So that's where people like us, funds like us, can go in and take a 50% loan to value on a perfectly good collateral with good cash flow support at 3x or 2x. And we can actually lend to these companies, and we can actually charge a fair premium. So we can charge like 12 to 15% for doing that loan. Now that makes it interesting because you have to, that is a kind of a person who's not able to get money from the local banks. If you're big enough, you'd probably go to the high yield bond market, but what if you're not that big, bigger company? So the mid-market lending is a very good direct lending, and it's a very safe part of the market. The second thing is the special situations, as we call it, is Asia, the underpinning, the tailwinds are actually all about equity. So you could see some companies which are growing at 20%. And let's say you want to buy your shareholder out, your co-partner or shareholder. And the guy says, I'm out, I just want to go. A bank will not lend you money for those things because the banks are very kind of regimented in the way of thinking. They'll give you for CapEx, they'll give you for hard assets, but they'll not give you money to buy your shareholders. So these are, or an acquisition financing. If you're acquiring in your own country, half of the banks won't lend. If you're acquiring outside your country, nobody's going to lend to you. So it's kind of these restrictions because of fragmentation. So the special situations are when a company gets into trouble, we'll buy the debt, we will also give them extra money, and we'll say, look, I'm helping your company go from 10 to 100. Why don't I take a little, not only do you pay me 10% coupon, but I also want 20% of the company for free warrants or something else. And these borrowers are willing to do it because they see themselves making 80% of the upside. Even if they give you 20%, they don't mind. And even if your debt is for 10% and you're making this, it is fine for them because they would not have alternate sources of capital. So our goal as Avenue is to be, we are not trying to look for distressed companies. We don't have to look for companies in trouble. Our job is to show up when somebody is in need of money and he's not able to tap that capital, is to put our proprietary, throw our fishing net, so to speak, and reach those companies and say, here's $50 million, and we're willing to do this. And that's the entire focus. The third piece, which is the traded piece, is that piece is very much, you know, some of the people would have heard about the China real estate meltdown and Evergrande and all these stories. So when these bonds, because of this kind of event, or the other thing is as the Fed starts hiking interest rate, and this is something that we believe is going to be a really big opportunity because if the Fed hikes interest rates or hits 2 or 3 50-bit hikes, Asia will not be widening by 150 bits. It'll be widening by 3 or 5 or 10 points because Asia, a lot of money will first run away from Asia because people are naturally scared. They'll be like, oh, let's pull money out of Asia. They probably dump a lot of bonds, which are good companies, quasi-sovereigns, et cetera. And so our job is to wait for these big shifts in the markets, whether it's COVID-related, geopolitical-related, or interest rate hike-related, pick out companies which should be trading at 90 or 100 cents, and you will be able to buy them at 70 cents. And that's why that strategy is extremely attractive. So over a longer period of time, all three strategies will probably be in play for a very long time. So we built a platform that can do all three. So we have a team of people who source proprietary deals. We call them the country managers. We have a team of analysts who are doing bottom-up analysis, and then we have a team of people who do restructurings and enforcements if required. So we have the full platform, and it's a question of which way are we going today and based on where the opportunities that is coming.
And kind of just spending, you know, or double-clicking a little bit on the kind of special situations component of the platform. You know, you mentioned some of these kind of like maybe non-corporate performance type drivers that might cause someone to, you know, need an injection of some capital of some kind. What are some of those drivers, and how much of those are kind of structural to the countries as well? I know we've talked about a little bit about capital flight and kind of some of the restrictions there. Currency, any other things that kind of really might cause, you know, non-corporate performance, but these companies that kind of really suffer and need some additional capital?
Yeah, so I'll give you two or three examples as we're not going to specific deals, but for example, we had a company that if a company, let's say there's a shareholder goes bankrupt, and let's say it's a large financial conglomerate, and they kind of go and put up, they have to suddenly meet their creditor payments. They appoint a bankruptcy consultant, and they start selling a bunch of portfolio assets. We have been able to buy some really good assets at really distressed prices, not because the underlying performing company was not performing, but because the shareholder went through a stress. So we went in and bought. We gave an acquisition financing to a couple of private equity sponsors, and we gave them a loan, and we also took some equity stakes in the company. So performance was great. The shareholder issues were predominant. In other cases, the other things that drive it is, let's say a bank in India or China has to provision. Let's say a company goes through a restructuring. A bank has to immediately provide for that loan, so they will not keep the loan at 100 cents. Even though the company is doing well, once it goes into restructuring, they move it into what is called a workout group. And once they move it into the workout group, they have to start provisioning. And once they provide for the loan, it changes the hands from a relationship manager who is dealing with it day to day to someone who actually doesn't care about the asset. Their job is to actually clean the workout book. So they will come in and say, look, I want to sell this loan at a 40 cents or a 50 cents, and I want to get out. The restructuring that happened was left the company in a good place, but still, and the company is performing, but the holder of the debt cannot hold it anymore. So they'll give it to you. Our job is to find the debt, buy it at 50 cents on the dollar, work with the sponsor of the company, and negotiate some part of a payment period plus some negotiation to the equity. So that's the second piece. And the currency piece that you mentioned is absolutely the reason why the 1997 financial crisis happened, because currency suddenly moved very wide and people could not service their debt anymore. So the same performance, but in a different currency, it looked half as good. So it suddenly defaulted the debt. So I think I love that. So from our perspective, we hedge all currencies back to the US dollars because we don't want to be the ones at the other end of the receiving thing. So we hedge our currencies back to the US dollars. We kind of find ways to hedge broadly portfolios, but our entire situations are very idiosyncratic. And we spend a lot of time finding good companies with bad or distressed sellers. That's where we spend the time on the special situation bucket.
Okay, very helpful. And just to kind of put a bow kind of on special situations, you know, how important is kind of experience in this, right? I imagine all of these situations might be a little bit different and really idiosyncratic to the company, the environment, the situation. How much would you say both experience and kind of expertise play into, you know, helping to create potentially better outcomes?
I think it is, I would say the best, my comment on that is, I would say it's 100%. It's all experience driven. Because I think it's not about, a lot of people can find the situations. What a lot of people can't find or agree is knowing when to walk away from the table. And what I mean by that is, if you are sitting with unlike in the US, where a lot of companies are professionally owned or owned by shareholders, in Asia, a lot of companies are either owned by the governments or there are a lot of families still own the businesses. So these families are a chairman of a company who's built it for 20, 30 years, is looking at you come in and walk and buy the debt at 50 cents on the dollar. He's not exactly happy paying you 100 cents on the debt and also giving you like a big stake in the equity. So what happens for us, experienced professionals, is we have seen this over time. I have struck deals with people to say, we will make 3X. And the chairman of the company would come and say, Anil, I think you're making too much money. Can you just leave some money on the table for me? How about you take 2.7 or 2.5 and I will do something else with you. But the point is, fighting for the last pennies is sometimes not the smartest thing in the world. I think it is knowing when to disengage and knowing how to take some of your return up front and gather. Like if you're making 2 times or 3 times, you're doing well enough and on an investment. So in a 1 or 2 years, if it's worked out. So what we try not to do is fight for the last penny, and knowing what drives this and motivates these partners on the corporate side that we work with is that comes from experience. There is no substitute. I think US bankruptcy process, same in the UK, are slightly different from Asia. And I think that nuances have to be captured, and so that we end up doing, you know, safer business rather than going to court and trying to figure this out over a longer period of time. And it's something that we consciously do. So we tell it internally, we have a rule, 2x in 2 years is better than 3x in 3, because if the world dislocates, your 3x is not there. So you may actually just hit a speed bump. So just take the 2x. And we are fundamentally credit investors, so we respect that a lot. We want to get the yield. We want to get the return of capital. Then we want to make a multiple. So our approach is built on that sensitivity and experience.
Okay, very helpful. And so, you know, kind of just to contextualize the both the Avenue kind of Asia platform and then also kind of just the opportunity set overall, how do you all kind of think about in terms of the global landscape? What do you view as being some of the opportunities within the Asia market that maybe are different or perhaps more attractive on some bases than those in, you know, developed US or perhaps even Europe?
So, look, I think we respect the fact that the fact that I'm in Avenue, I get the benefit of actually sharing with my colleagues in the US, in Europe. I get to hear the worldwide global perspective. And I can say Avenue does not operate in Latin America. We don't do those. So we are effectively the emerging market end of this spectrum. So when we think about what happens with the right now, what's on my mind is if the Fed is starting to hike interest rates, how does Asia react to it? And how does Asia credit and all these opportunities react? The first things, the private markets don't react that quickly to international events like a Fed hike, et cetera, because borrowers of companies which are borrowing for 4 or 5 years, they would not come overnight and say, I was paying 12% yesterday, today I want to pay 15%. They don't do that overnight. They will need to see a few quarters of pain. They want to really test it and see if they really have to pay it. But the public markets in Asia will react very quickly. So right now in the short period of time, 3-6 months, we are thinking there's going to be more opportunity on the public side. In the private side, our edge comes from just being able to have these licensed platforms and being able to offer a solution when other global firms or regional firms don't have those licenses and they can't go and offer that capital. Even if they're offering capital, their funding is probably coming as an unsecured debt or a mezzanine debt. Whereas we are doing it as a senior secured debt, and we are doing it in local currency. So even from the borrower's perspective or even from our investor's perspective, we are structuring something far superior. So what I worry about is when the Fed hike, first people were worried about the Fed hikes that are going to come through potentially. That led to a widening of credit in Asia, unrelated to the China real estate. The second thing is when Fed actually does 50 bips hikes and it does 2-3 of them, I think there will be even more widening of credit. And the last thing is people overestimate their ability to service debt. I think we have seen this over time, especially mid-market companies. They kind of, who don't have multiple ways of accessing capital markets, equity or public bond markets, 2-3 quarters of paying $40 million extra in your interest rate will suddenly start putting strain on the cash flows. And we think that will capitulation will happen probably in around 12 months. So when we're running a funds, we run funds which are 6-year vehicles, 6+2 vehicles, and we run short-dated funds. But if you're thinking about a cycle, we are thinking over the next 2 to 3 years, where will the opportunity set be? And I think the biggest one will be from the dislocation because of interest rate hikes. I think that'll be the biggest driver. The other things that are China real estate or India, a rebound in India, Make in India programs, or in Australia, we will probably see some more capital kind of go into commodities because of what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. So there are other local themes that we follow. But I think the biggest theme is actually the interest rate hikes and how all Asian countries will be trying to deal with inflation and interest rate hikes and how that leads to opportunities over 3, 6, and 12 months. I think that's the biggest story. And every country is going to react differently, but it's going to be the biggest driver.
And then just in terms of, you know, conversations that you have with folks out there, you know, when Avenue's talking to their clients and beyond, what are some of the things that you think that those clients get wrong about Asia? Whether that's kind of like maybe some biased perceptions on, you know, what you were talking about earlier about this perceived risk. Obviously, there's a bit of a U.S. home bias where folks tend to overallocate based even on market capitalizations globally to their home country. What are kind of some of the things that you notice in talking to clients that they kind of miss about the Asian market overall?
Sure. I think there is the home bias. I think you're right. I've definitely seen there is a comfort in investing in something that you think you know. The question is, if you are working through managers like us, or if you kind of spend a little bit more time to understand how these underlying economies are, Asia there are two, three things that are not understood about Asia. Asia has probably around 40%, 60% of the world's population. It has got 40% of the world's GDP, and it has got 7% of the AUM of private capital flowing in. So if you think about it, it is deeply dislocated from that perspective. There are very few funds who are like us trying to do it bottom up. So the opportunity set for us is massive, and the amount of capital that you're competing with is very low. Unlike in the US, you actually have a lot of capital available. And so it is possible to create a big delta in returns because of the demand supply situation. The second thing, I think from a growth perspective, yes, there is a lot of volatility in the markets, but if you're investing in funds that are kind of sitting over 3, 4, 5, 6 year opportunity set, what you're capturing is not just the safety of a company that we invested, which is a 100 million EBITDA business. After 3, 4 years here, the growth rates are high. We see these businesses becoming $200, $300 million EBITDA businesses. So you're not only buying the credit safety in a well-structured deal, but you're also getting the equity upside in these transactions. And I think that's an important piece. That equity upside has been fairly consistent in Asia over a longer period of time. The other thing is people think that it is the group Asia is like, oh, I had a bad experience in one country and it's all bad. The reason we do this portfolio the way we do it is we believe people should not have to worry about the half of the portfolio, which is a developed market. That's predictable, that's familiar, move on with it. The rest of it, we have boots on the ground, we have licenses in those countries, and we have de-risked that. And the third thing is we hedge currencies, and because we have Avenue invest money alongside all these products, we are putting our own money alongside in these deals, and we are aligned with the success of these platforms. And we've been doing it for over 20 years. So that is what I think it's not a one-off experience somebody has, should not be the way you paint the canvas entirely. It should be something that you, distressed credit or idiosyncratic credit is all about peeling the onion and looking under the hood and seeing what makes sense. And I think we do that. And I think investors would benefit over a longer period of time, getting that extra return, and not just return, but also multiple over a period of time in this product. I think it is, whatever you say, over the next few years, Asia private credit will be a big opportunity set over multiple years, over a decade or so. So I think people should definitely keep their eyes and ears open and participate in it in some way. But the key is education and being able to look at it in depth.
Anil, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm kind of curious for you if there's anything that we didn't get a chance to talk to that you really wish that we did.
No, I think, Peter, this has been great as well. Thank you for really touching on some really important points. And I think I would say that we look forward to, I know Mark spoke on this platform as well. We look forward to being in touch and appreciate the partnership.
Yeah, of course we do as well. And thank you so much, Anil, for everything. And obviously, I wish you all great success with your Avenue Asia Strategy platform.
Thank you.
Thanks, you. Peter.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%.
Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.